Stunned silence.
What is
this? A bit of an episode, right?
So I must be doing something wrong.
And it's playing its playing as that's it.
Tell us what you're doing.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm. You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 79 for April 15, 2014. I'm your host, James, and we're in the virtual rendition studios again tonight, given to the fact that our producer is off. Well, he hasn't been off having a baby, but his wife has, and congratulations to Joseph and the wonderful little family. So we're stuck with Skype, but that's okay because we've got the one and only Gavin. How are you doing, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. Nice to join you virtually this evening.
Indeed, indeed. And we have also the wonderful Lucy. How are you, Lucy?
Good, thank you. I'm also joined by my dog, Billy, but he's reasonably quiet right now.
That's tempting fate right there by commenting on how quiet the dog is, I must say. How's everyone doing? How's your Lent been, given that we're in Holy Week and almost done?
I was thinking, I can't remember if we've ever recorded in Holy Week before.
Probably have
in the course of 7 years or thereabouts, but it's possible that we haven't, I suppose. The vagaries of liturgical and other calendars
indeed
might not happen, but it's almost that wonderful time of the year.
Bring it on, I say. Mm. What about you, Lucy? What did you give up for Lent? What are you looking forward to getting back into?
I'm 18, almost 18 weeks pregnant, so
yes.
I think that's, yeah, great. Yay, exciting.
this is announcing to the world.
There's not a lot else you can give up for Lent by the time you're pregnant.
That's a good point.
But you don't have to fast. And so my husband has sometimes been like, I'm not fasting in solidarity with you, but I'll have a drink on your behalf.
Oh, that's very kind of him. That's very kind
of
him.
Yeah, really inconsistent too.
Theologically questionable.
Questionable. Speaking of theologically questionable, the New Zealand bishops, this is from NZ Catholic, New Zealand bishops say that young people are not encountering Jesus in Catholic schools. Most Catholic educated young people in New Zealand are not encountering Jesus Christ through their schooling, New Zealand's Catholic bishops say. The bishops have published a document, The Catholic Education of School-Aged Children, that discusses a number of problems with faith education and the likely solutions. The document is based in large part on doctoral thesis research by Chris Duthie-Young of Wellington, called Faith Amid Secularity. The document says that although Catholic schools deliver a sound education, that is not why they exist. That end can be met by state schools. Catholic schools are where the living God should be encountered. The bishops write that young adult Pākehā Catholics between 18 and 28 see themselves as Catholic, sense the presence of God, believe in basic goodness, but also display a disconnect at the level of faith acting in ordinary life. For most of them, being Catholic is cultural rather than a commitment. In fact, there seems to be little difference between young Catholics and young non-religious adults of goodwill. Gavin, this makes for some pretty confronting reading. I have to say, I haven't read the whole thesis or anything, but what did you make of what the bishops were saying in their document?
Well, I think in many ways it's a reasonably brave admission by the bishops, because I think this is something that a lot of people in 79 episodes, maybe not half of them, have talked about the importance of Catholic education, but certainly it's been a recurring theme during our time on the podcast about the Catholicity or the effectiveness of Catholic education in New Zealand. And it's not, you know, isolated to New Zealand. I think it's largely happening around the West. So to come out and for the bishops to say, yes, we acknowledge that, that the Catholic schools aren't necessarily coming out having encountered God during their schooling is, many would say that's an indictment, really, on what's been happening. And I suppose the big point is, where to from here? What are they going to do to try and change that so that the schools can be what they say that the schools should be?
I mean, let's be honest, Lucy, there's a little bit of Emperor's New Clothes about this. I think a lot of Catholics have spoken for a while about the lack of, particularly in secondary school, the lack of Catholic focus. As we've talked about before on the show, Catholic schools in New Zealand are integrated schools, which means that they get part government and part church funding. And for that arrangement, that means that there's a portion of students that don't have to have been baptized even to be able to get into the schools. But what did you make of this? I mean, are the bishops just confronting a reality that we're already aware of, or are they way off?
No, absolutely. And there is, they kind of say, you know, a problem well stated is a problem half solved. And I think, as you say, it is a brave admission, and it's a really important step to come out and say, look, this is not achieving what it should be. Our schools are not achieving what they should be fundamentally. So I think the only way is up from here, so to speak, because you can't really say that and then kind of pussyfoot around it, you know. And certainly that was my experience in high school as well. I used to say that I probably would have been more Catholic if I'd gone to a secular high school, because there were times where I felt like that because it was totally uncool to live out your faith, because that was associated with being a geek, because you were more involved with like teachers and school stuff instead of just, do you know what I mean? Like, whereas at a secular school, it kind of had people didn't really feature, and you could just do your thing and nobody would ask too many questions, you know? So, I think it's a really good admission. I think the trouble now is going to be finding the capacity to, the teachers with the, you know, and the time and the formation to really change that.
So Gavin, I mean, what do you think the bishops? Okay, so the bishops give you a call and they go, Gavin, advise us. What should we do first? What's the first thing we can do? What's the low hanging fruit, as we'd say in the corporate world? What's the first thing we can do that would have maximum impact?
Well, I think one of the things they point to is this idea about the role of teachers, essentially, and being transmitters of the faith, and people who can model the faith to their students. I think that's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. I don't know whether that would classify as low-hanging fruit, because that's a long process. But I think it's maybe having some sort of program whereby, see, in other countries it's probably a little bit easier because there's sort of a tertiary Catholic system. Oh, you know, even in Australia, there's a handful of Catholic universities around the country. In the States, there's hundreds, whereby teachers can be nurtured in a way where their faith and their teaching skills are being developed at the same time.
Right.
So I think having teachers who have that sense of being people who love God and love the church can permeate down to the students. But at the moment, for a range of reasons, not least the fact that people who are cradle Catholics drift away from their faith in their 20s and 30s for the most part, that teachers aren't those people who are able to pass that along. Not to mention the fact that priests and brothers and sisters, for that matter, are less visible. There are fewer of them. So they're not in our schools to pass along the faith that way as well. So there's a range of different things, I think, around the adults in our schools and how they can show young people about the love of God and love of church.
What about, and I mean, I think I may have espoused this theory before, but what about the idea of moving confirmation back to later on, to age 15?
Amen.
The reason why I say it is that when I think about, so my wife was a primary school teacher and she was actually head of religious studies. And she found that for primary school age children, so, you know, 7 and 8 year olds, who were going through the formation of leading up to the sacraments of initiation and, you know, communion, First Holy Communion and reconciliation and such, they were, the curriculum had quite a clear focus. And there was a shared liturgical experience, a shared in the sacrament that everyone was going through at the same time. And it just seems to me that maybe secondary education, Lucy, the kind of high school education, lacks a little bit of focus for the religious education aspect.
Yeah, no, I would definitely be in agreement with the idea of shifting the confirmation age. And I've seen it in, well, when I lived in Sweden, which was mainly Luther, and their confirmation was in the high school. And I can't speak based on that because I don't think it was necessarily, it's not the same faith either. Well, you know, it's Lutheran, but I think that with really like well-developed materials and well-formed teachers, yeah, it could be an incredibly an experience, a sacrament that really that speaks to the stage of life that they're at, with all their insecurities and all the challenges and all the uncertainties of being a teenager, and realizing at that critical juncture that all of that will be answered in some respect by putting their faith in Christ, even if they're not quite sure how that's going to look or whatever. But to make that commitment at that point, yeah, I think it would be really important. I also was wondering what, you know, like you say, you mentioned Australia sort of having some really good systems like that too. Perhaps one of the easier ways to begin, I don't know, is to partner up somehow with the structures that there are in Australia, just for the sake of sharing and learning, that the Catholic education structure in New Zealand makes a point to engage across the Tasman, because I'm sure there's a lot of resources that are developed in Australia that could be easily tweaked. And of course, loads in, you know, abroad in the US and things, but perhaps Australia is a little closer to us in terms of culturally. To, you know, like, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. There is a lot of good curriculum out there, I'm sure, in other countries that, you know, and I would say a review of the curriculum is probably goes hand in hand with the teachers. I agree the teachers as well need to be able to feel like they're being supported and formed in their own faith journey, because they certainly can't pass it on unless they're nourished themselves.
Yeah.
So.
So, because I'm not sure, for example, the Catholic Institute, I think is now the name of it, the sort of the amalgamation of the Catholic Institute of Theology in Auckland and the Wellington Catholic Education Centre that was set up. I'm not sure what, I'm displaying ignorance here, whether there's any relationship it has in terms of trying to help train teachers for Catholic schools, primary and secondary, but that's an opportunity. But whether it's Australia, you know, is there some sense in which teachers can be encouraged to take up scholarships, then the bishops provide money for that.
Right.
Yeah.
Young people who are showing an interest, who are practicing Catholics, who are showing an interest in teaching, that there's some way to support those people. You know, we have, we all have friends who are teachers who are good Catholics but teach in secular schools. How do we try and get those practicing faithful Catholics into our Catholic schools to try and have them be those living witnesses that we're looking for? But I certainly agree with the idea of confirmation, moving back to 15 or 16, which is when I was confirmed. And I think it's, and I'm sure I wrote an editorial about it in NZ Catholic at some stage, making this exact point that from about the age of 9, you can sort of drift in the sacramental wilderness. Hopefully you go to communion quite a bit, but in terms of those life markers, if you will, there aren't any. And I've long said that was, you know, I'm not saying it's a failed experiment, but I think maybe a lost opportunity or a missed opportunity is a better way to describe it.
I also think it's potentially, best intentions. But, I mean, the idea being that, you know, we should be get an exposure to the gifts of the Spirit and that sacrament as early on as possible. And it helps prepare one, especially the gift of wisdom, for the reception of the Eucharist. But I would have also said that you're going to have a huge amount of grace poured amongst you from receiving the Eucharist anyway. And there's nothing to say that you couldn't do with a bit of a boost when you're hitting your... I mean, I was confirmed at 15, and that was just when they were starting to transition back to having it at 8. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this is actually the point where I'm making a decision that this is my faith, not my parents. And I'm going to go to Mass on Sunday, not because my parents will kick me into the car, but because it's something I should be doing. So even if that's an associated benefit of the sacrament being at that age, I just think that there's nothing to anchor religious education. Well, sorry, I shouldn't say nothing. It's difficult to anchor religious education at the secondary level when you don't know what you're preparing them for. In the sense
there's no
commonality, right? There's nothing that you can guarantee, well, I'm going to be I'm preparing everyone for confirmation. You can't say you're preparing everyone for marriage because some may be for holy orders. You can't say you're preparing everyone for holy orders because some may be for marriage or single life. So you're kind of left with this, well, what am I teaching them? And then you run into the hairy, you know, difficult bits as well, including, you know, sex education and humana vitae and all those kind of questions start coming at the same time. And it just seems that there's an inadequacy in the religious component of the education. So it's not really that surprising that they're not encountering Jesus in Catholic schools.
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe we just need to take some responsibility for that and figure out how we can move forward. Speaking of taking responsibility on a far more serious matter, this is from the Associated Press. Pope Francis said on Friday that he took personal responsibility for the evil of priests who raped and molested children, asking forgiveness from victims and saying the church must be even bolder in its efforts to protect the young. It was the first time a pope has taken personal responsibility for the sex crimes of his priests and begged forgiveness. Francis's off-the-cuff remarks were the latest sign that he has become sensitized to the gravity of the abuse scandal after coming under criticism from victims' advocacy groups for a perceived lack of attention to and understanding of the toll it has taken on the church and its members. Goodness me, Associated Press, feel free to use some punctuation. The evolution began last month when he named four women and an abuse survivor to a sex abuse advisory panel that the Vatican suggested will address the critical issue of sanctioning bishops who cover up for pedophiles. Francis delivered the comments to members of the International Catholic Child Bureau, a French Catholic network of organizations that protects children's rights. Sitting with them in his library on Friday, Francis spoke slowly, deliberately, and softly in his native Spanish, deviating from his text. Quote, I feel compelled to take personal responsibility for all the evil that some priests, many, many a number, although not in comparison with the totality, to assume personal responsibility and to ask forgiveness for the damage caused by the sexual abuse of the children. The church is aware of this damage. We don't want to take a step back in dealing with this problem and the sanctions that must be imposed. On the contrary, I think we must be even stronger. You don't play around with the lives of children, end quote. This is pretty powerful stuff, Gavin, to have the Pope taking personal responsibility for the abuse of priests of young children by priests.
Yeah, it had been one area that over the first 13 months of his pontificate, a lot of people had been wondering what the Pope was going to do tangibly in terms of abuse. I think there was a sense that he had the right ideas and his heart was in the right place and wanted to do the right thing. And between these comments that have just been made over the last few days, plus his establishment of the commission putting women, an abuse victim, a senior cardinal, and among other lay people as well, on this new commission. I think this is a very positive sign that everyone should take, but particularly those people who have been critical of him, as a very tangible sign that he's going to deal with this swiftly and with seriousness. And for those of us in Australia currently dealing with a royal commission, so you know, high-scale investigation into how institutions have responded to child sexual abuse. It's something for us here to look at and be thankful for the Pope, but taking the step at this stage.
Lucy, what did you make? I mean, the fact that he's taking personal responsibility for actions that have taken place in the past. He wasn't the Pope at the time. I mean, that's quite powerful, don't you think?
Hmm. And I think that, being who he is as Pope, it's almost like he kind of needs to go to that extent to signal that there's absolutely no gap in his sentiment towards this, you know, like that it certainly absolutely undoubtedly goes beyond well, we need to address this because I'm the head of this institution, as opposed to we need to address this because I'm, you know, deeply, that this is just so utterly wrong. And I think it's an example we can take away from it as individual Catholics when it comes up. I know I've had conversations with people where they've been like, you know, they ask you, well, what do you make of the abuse? Like, how can you How can you stay there when that's happened? And the last thing you want to do is try to kind of downplay in any regard, you know, go, oh, well, there it was only a few out of, a, you know, like,
yeah.
or any of that kind of language. And in fact, to just draw kind of deeper even into the tragedy of it. And so it's just we're willing to use even stronger language than the rest of the world is using, because in fact, with our faith perspective, we can realize how much even worse this is than even the secular world understands it to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, they see it as terrible, but we realize how even more deeply terrible it is and what a symptom it is of this, of what, you know, certain sickness and wound in the church. So I think that by not just using language for its own sake, but by taking that personal responsibility, he's setting an example for all of us to not try and downplay it, but to just go also respond as strongly whenever we're asked as well. Because I don't know about you guys, but it's definitely come up for me.
Yeah, well, absolutely it has. And again, I know we've spoken about it many times on the podcast in terms of how difficult it is for, I mean, nowhere near in comparison to those who have suffered, obviously, but how difficult it is to be a proud Catholic and try and defend the faith in light of what's you know, an absolute, you just run out of words. There's just, you know, atrocity, you know, this terrible evil. That some, you know, granted a small number, but even as the Pope admits, there are way too many have inflicted. And you're left saying, well, many of the times you're trying to work around the words to not make excuses, but at the same time defend that it's not everyone and so on. And here's the Pope saying, you know what? It's basically a very powerful way of saying the buck stops with me. For the spiritual and emotional damage, I'm taking full responsibility. I mean, Gavin, I'm still sort of quite sort of set back. I've taken aback by his ability to do that. I mean, this is to take personal responsibility for something that you're not actually responsible for. That's quite out there.
And I wonder if it's any coincidence that this has happened during Easter, during Lent and leading up to Easter. We have an example of somebody who's taken the failings of others and upon himself, let's say.
Yeah.
So I think it is a wonderfully pastoral thing to have done. I think there have been some, particularly from Pope Benedict, there were some very strong statements, and the text that you read suggests this is unprecedented. I haven't read everything that Pope Benedict said about the topic, so I won't suggest that that's not true what they've said, but there has been a lot of movement towards these very deep and unreserved apologies coming from Pope Benedict previously. But I think this is again taking it to another level. In this season of Lent, as we prepare for Easter, I think it's probably possibly quite a symbolic move.
Yeah, and it's very powerful, and I think that it just reminds us that we can always do better, and it doesn't matter who you are. There's always more that you can do. But yes, very very powerful stuff. Speaking of powerful and sacrifice, this is from the AFP. A Dutch priest, Frans van der Lugt, and I apologize if I've got his name pronounced wrong, who gained
Father
renown.
Father Roderick will let you know.
Yeah, I'm sure he will. Who gained renown for his insistence on staying in Syria's besieged Homs, has been shot dead in the city by an unknown gunman. His death was reported by Syria's state news agency SANA and the opposition Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, and was confirmed by the Dutch Jesuit Order. The motive for his murder was unclear. Van der Lugt, who was 75, had become a well-known figure in the old city of Homs, respected by many for his solidarity with residents of the rebel-held area under a government siege for nearly 2 years. He refused to leave despite constant shelling and dwindling supplies, insisting that Syria was his home and he wanted to be with the country's citizens in their time of need. I can confirm that he's been killed, Jan Stuyt, secretary of the Dutch Jesuit Order, said by phone. A man came into his house, took him outside, and shot him twice in the head in the street in front of his house. That's just, this is just terrible. Sweet said that he was not aware of particular threats to Vandeloot, adding that the priest would be buried in Syria according to his wishes. Vandeloot spent nearly 5 decades in Syria and said in February that he considered the country to be his home. The Syrian people have given me so much kindness, inspiration, and everything they have. If the Syrian people are suffering now, I want to share their pain and their difficulties, he said. Lucy, this is, you know, just absolutely terrible, terrible news. And it's a reminder, I think, and, you know, you've through your job, as we've connected with you at far-flung places before, have been a reminder for our listeners that actually it's not all sunshine and lollipops in the modern world of tolerance when it comes to people of our faith.
Mm. No, I mean, yeah, you're right. It's absolutely horrific what's happened. I think it reminds me also of the monks of Tiberin, the seven Trappist monks in Algeria that were in a similar kind of fashion. Well, theirs, I think, was more drawn out in 96, were all assassinated as well. And there's a very good movie that was made. I can't remember the name, but you can Google it. Very powerful film to watch, I think. You know, the weeks before I left Pakistan, you know, there was a priest I was working with on some charity work, you know, and he wasn't turning up for the meeting, and wasn't answering his phone, and, you know, a bit of a, like, come on, Father, like, keep up, you know. He's like, sorry, I've been too busy dealing with the death threats that turned up on my door the other week. Like, oh, right, Father's got a bit else to deal with on his plate, you know, apart from running a big parish and dealing with all of those issues. And, you know, I'm sure that Frans Vandeloup, you know, he would be like this too. You know, those who knew him day to day, he had all his funny little quirks and his sort of weaknesses and strengths and everything else, but he was just human like anyone. But that calling that he had to Syria, it is quite a unique calling. And there's another priest again that I worked with a lot in Pakistan, who was not Pakistani and had been there for 30 years. And I said to him, you know, I asked him, like, what is it how did you ever doubt why, you know, how could you stay there for so long? Or, you know, he said, I knew all along. I knew always that Pakistan was where I was called to be, and I've never had a doubt. And I mean, that's incredible. And I think, I'm sure that Father Frans is is a similar case, like nearly 5 decades. And you see the way he talks about the Syrian people, you know, staying there is not just some kind of, because I'm so strong and I need to protect them. It's what else could I do after all that I owe them, my life and love and fruitfulness comes from them. So I could never leave them, which is such an extraordinary life to have had, you know, like, we bop around the world and keep moving, you know, every 2 years, you know, like, we've no idea, not we as in you guys, but, you know, my husband and I and the people that we work with, you know, we just, in fact, it's almost part of the way we're supposed to do things that we don't get attached to an area, you know, and this is a total, it's just, it is profound. And I think that without wanting to justify it, there's something incredibly fitting about him dying for Syria, being killed for Syria, true martyrdom for, as a witness to his the outpouring of Christ's love and grace in him.
Yeah, I mean, he's. I think it's, I can't really add much to that. It's beautifully said, Lucy. I mean, you know, Gavin, this is. Let's call him who he is. I mean, Saint Frans Vandeloup, because he's a martyr. There's no doubt about that. What an incredible man, and just a really, it's very, again, this is a very confronting episode, this episode of the 15th Station on Holy Week. But I mean, it does, you know, here are two examples, very different, but here are two examples of you know, men of the cloth basically really taking their role as in persona Christi quite seriously.
Yeah, and I think you're both parents. On the way, Luce, already a parent, but just waiting to welcome your child into the world. To me, as a non-parent, I look at this as, you know, Father Vandeloot looks at himself, I guess, as like a father figure to these people.
Mm.
And just as if an intruder came into your house, James, you would see your role as to protect your family.
Mm.
And, you know, the circumstances around something like this are often hard to quite pin down exactly what happened and why it happened. But I think there's certainly no doubt that he's a martyr. But, you know, I think Father Franz was just looking at himself as protecting his family and looking out for their interests.
Yeah.
And to do that for some people, I mean, they have become his family over the course of 5 decades.
Yeah.
I mean, in much the same way, Pope Francis sees himself as a father to the church, and that he has to take on the sins of his brother priests, of his flock, or he feels that way. And that shows a, you know, incredibly deep faith and commitment to what they're doing. And it's really inspirational in both counts.
It is, and I think it's stories like this, which, not to try and minimise them or trivialise them, but it is witness examples of witness like this that that I like to refer to when people ask me, so why are you Catholic? Why are you still, you know, in the face of everything that's been going on in the church, why are you still Catholic? And you look at people like this and you say, well, it's because people like this show me that there is something that what I believe in is actually not just worth living for, it's worth dying for. I mean, they just do such an incredible job. And I think, I just pray for the repose of the soul of Father Franz. Not that I think he needs my prayers. What an incredible man, and just so sad, so tragic. Well, from the kind of depths of despair, let's talk about a little bit of new hope. This is from the New Zealand Catholic. 8 new first-year seminarians at Holy Cross Seminary make for a diverse group reflecting the increasingly multicultural nature of the church in New Zealand. But although there might be 7 different ethnicities represented, most of them are young, aged in their 20s. I'm going to just do terribly with these names. Fadi Bolis, who's 21, was born in Iraq, but his family migrated to Syria in 2000. In 2012, his family came to New Zealand as refugees, joining his sister who had married there. Mr. Bolis hopes to be ordained a priest in the Chaldean Catholic Rite, but he will also be able to celebrate the Latin Rite normally used in New Zealand. Last year, he was ordained as a subdeacon by Chaldean Patriarch Louis Raphael Isako.
I think it's the first.
I think that might be like the first. Raphael's first. What's the Sarko then?
Well, I think that's possibly his last name.
I think it's probably... Anyway, the Chaldean Patriarch, when he visited New Zealand, Mr. Bolis first felt a calling to priesthood when he was in Syria, and the kindness of the family his family received there was a factor. I felt a call from God because of other people. They dealt with us like brothers, even though we were strangers. We have been helped by many churches, even Muslim people, he said. We'll put the link in the show notes to the full story, and you can go through and read about the other seminarians so that I don't butcher their names as well. But this is very positive stuff, Gavin. I mean, you know, following in the footsteps of the previous story about how important, you know, the priests are, here are 8 new first-year seminarians, and quite young.
Most of them are young, and as the sort of the first line of the story suggests, it is very reflective of the way that the church is changing in New Zealand, and again, in other parts of the world as well. If you look at how the church has become far more quote-unquote Asian in New Zealand, people from China and Korea and India, and even sort of the Middle East as well. We've had quite a big Chaldean Catholic community in Auckland, more so than other parts of the country. You know, if you look to the States, I suspect you'd see a similar change in the last 10 or 15 years towards a more Hispanic makeup of in seminaries around the US. And certainly in Australia, you're seeing Vietnamese and other Asian cultures becoming very prominent in the pews and in our seminaries. So it is positive, I think, you know, a very good intake for small country like New Zealand. We have to be mindful that we're losing priests at a much faster rate than we're gaining them in terms of domestic seminarians and domestic priests. And again, that international flavour is helping to try and maintain the numbers of priests in New Zealand. But when we get eight young men who have signed up and said, you know, this is something I want to do with my life, that's an inspiration to a lot of people as well, so including me. So all the best to them. We know that it's a long process and there's a long way to go, but we wish them the best as they start on this journey.
We very much do. It's good news, isn't it, Lucy? I mean, there's no two ways about it. This is a good result.
Absolutely. And it's like, I just think, you know, here in Bangkok, where we've just moved to, the English speaking parish, which still has mass in Thai as well, five masses on a Sunday/Saturday vigil with, you know, five priests in the parish of African, Thai and other origins. And the community that comes to mass is so diverse. And I think, in my home parish in St. Thomas More in Glenfield, Auckland, also I remember, you know, the statistic was we had 55 nationalities in the parish. And I do remember as a teenager, and ever since I've always held that as quite precious, something about our church, and been quite proud of this fact as I've, you know, gone about the world. And you can go into almost any corner of the world and find mass on a Sunday, you know. And it is one of the extraordinary things that is a sign of, well, it's the universality of the church, and it's something quite incredible that no other human institution manages to, I think, replicate in quite the same fashion. And I, you know, with all due respect, I'd even say, you know, in the Muslim world, like, you know, culturally, even if we're a minority, it's taken hold in every corner. You know, there's almost nowhere that's untouched. So these seminarians are indeed a fruit of that. And I think what's neat too is that, you know, I've had the experience of having priests shipped into the parish from overseas, where it's not gone, say, fantastically well in terms of their cultural, you know, their acculturation or their ability to kind of fit into a new culture. And it's caused, you know, ruffled a few feathers here and there, whereas these guys are going to have this wonderful kind of combination of their own cultural experiences and background that will allow them to minister both to their own cultural kin as well as to many other cultures, and to kind of also get familiar with the sort of culture in New Zealand, if you like, which pastorally is a very critical factor, I think, as we increasingly need to rely on both, you know, on international kind of seminarians and priests from other countries as well. I think that's really key. So to have them having their formation in New Zealand amongst each other is, I think, a very enriching experience in addition to the rich experience of seminary life itself.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think I'm sure I speak for the entire 15th Station crew when I wish all eight seminarians all the very best for their studies, and as they all go to respond to the call they've received from God, I think that's again great witness. This is the witness episode, I think, of the 15th Station, and we end with a story of fantastic witness in the key of G. A Catholic nun, this is from news.com.au, has become an overnight pop sensation after stunning the jury of Italy's The Voice television talent show with her version of Alicia Keys' No One. Sister Christina
Scucci,
a 25-year-old Sicilian, bopped? Okay.
She did. She bopped.
I wouldn't describe it as bopping, but anyway, bopped about on the stage in her black habit and a large cross necklace on Wednesday night's show, sparking wild cheers from the audience and stunned reactions from the four judges. "I came here because I have a gift that I want to share that gift," said the nun, who has an easy smile and is a member of the, how do you pronounce this one, Ursuline?
Ursuline, yeah.
Yeah, Sisters of the Holy Family. One of the judges, Italian rapper Jax, said he was moved to tears.
JX,
apologies. She said she had been inspired to go on the show by Pope Francis, who told us to come out of our convents and spread the word of God. Asked by Judge Raffaella Cara what the Vatican thinks about her going on a talent show, she quipped, "I'm waiting for a call from the Pope." Scuccia decided to become a nun after playing the part of a saint in a comic musical in 2007. This year's better and better, according to Italian media reports. The video of her performance has gone viral in Italy, with even the Vatican's Minister of Culture, Gianfranco Rovasi, tweeting his admiration. This was brilliant. I haven't seen the full video. But
you're missing out.
I've got
you
to
missed
watch
the bopping, I think.
Yeah, I must have missed the bopping.
We'll put it in the show notes.
It's pretty brilliant, though, isn't it? It's pretty great.
Fantastic. I watched it 4 times.
Did you?
And then shared it with, like everyone I knew, and I like made them sit down and watch it. Even my husband, and even he was like, "This is fantastic. You have to watch the whole thing. Google it and watch the whole 8 minutes."
Well, we've got the links. I'll put the link in to the news.com story, or Gavin will, because he's good like that.
We'll get it to the full one.
We'll go to the full one? Okay. Yep.
Yes,
so that we can see JX.
JX.
And all of the... So for those who haven't yet seen it, which is, where have you been? Because it's been on Facebook. It's been viral. But like the American and the Australian voice, the four judges all decide if they're going to choose this person to coach them through the show.
Yes.
And all four turn around because they all want, after hearing her voice, they decide they want her to be on their team, and then she has to make this big decision on which one she's going to have to be their coach. So, and they're not the sort of people, obviously Italy's an incredibly Catholic country, at least culturally. So it's interesting seeing their reactions when they turn around and see where this voice is coming from.
It's fantastic. No, it's brilliant. And again, it is actually, I'm not joking when I say it's another great example of Catholic witness, just very, very different. You've had the entire cornucopia of Catholic witness examples on the episode tonight, we've been happy to bring them to you. And if you want to go back and listen to some of the other the plethora of topics covered off on the previous 78 episodes, you can go check out our website at www.station15.co.nz, or you can look it up on the iTunes, the 15th station. If you want to reach out to us, we always love hearing from our listeners. You can reach us at twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15, or you can send us an email at podcast@station15.co.nz. That's for the retro vintage styles. If reading's more your thing, we do have some options for reading. Not as, potentially verbose as they have been in the past, but if you want to check out beingfrank.co.nz, you can get some really good Catholic opinion there. And if you want to go, again, at the moment, quite frankly, Gavin, a little bit retro, you can go to catholicsoapbox.com.
So I've decided that it was a retroactive, gave it up for Lent.
Right.
Because recently I've seen a few things that I think, I really should blog about that.
Yeah.
But I decided about halfway through that, okay, after Easter, I'm getting back into blogging.
The internet will look forward to your return.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it's still going, actually.
There's been a few of those things where life gets in the way. Lostsheep.tv is another example. This is our Google Plus Hangouts. We've got nearly 10 episodes up there. The last one just before did we do one in January or was it December? We need to get back into that as well. We're going to have a few things being resurrected after Easter, I think, because the call is there, and we may have some news on an upcoming little get-together as well.
We can announce that.
Can we?
It's on Facebook, man.
Oh, if it's on Facebook, then we can. You go. You give us the details.
It's on Facebook. It must be real.
What about CDMC?
So CDMC, you may have heard of something else last year that was held in Melbourne. Well, this year in Sydney, the Catholic Digital Media Conference, August 19 and 20, we've got some great people coming to speak. We're just teasing that at the moment. That's going to be announced next week after Easter. Your Easter joy will be extended so that you can find out who's coming to CDMC in Sydney on August 19 and 20. It's going to be at Mary Immaculate Place. I think the most important Catholic site in Australia, the resting place of Australia's first saint, St. Mary of the Cross MacKillop. So get in early, book your flights to Sydney, or if you live in Sydney, book your train ticket. And we'll look forward to seeing people for CDMC. So it's a chance for people who are involved in Catholic ministry, either professionally or personally, who want to get together and learn a bit more about how we can use digital media to evangelize the world, to reach out and be witnesses. So it'd be great to have people there. We'll have the website up by this time next month, so we'll let you know what the URL is, but have a look on Facebook at the moment and you'll be able to find out a bit more about it.
Brilliant stuff. CDMC 2014. Be there. It's going to be awesome. Thanks, Gavin, for that, and thanks for all your hard work again in getting up and running such a what will, I'm sure, be a fantastic gathering. Now, have I left any plugs out? I feel a bit rusty. I don't know why. Maybe it's the change in season. We're getting a lot of wind and rain. We didn't even do our 15-station weather report. But for those who are interested, we're now very much...
I was trying to phase that out as well.
Very much in autumn. Very much in autumn. And it was good fun. I got a little bit of taste of it, and then I caught up with Father Roderick when I was up in Holland. Yeah, in the Netherlands last month. And they know how to do cold up there. And he's sitting there going, oh, it's actually been really sort of quite, you know, quite warm. And I was like, I've never been colder in my life.
I need to come to Canberra.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, it can get quite chilly in Canberra. Yeah. Excellent. Hey, thanks so much, Lucy. We appreciate you taking the time to hang out with us on the show tonight. Thanks very much.
And Billy,
I was going to say.
Billy is
very quiet.
He's been
very good.
So well behaved. He knows that he can't play up right now.
Gavin, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, James, for guiding the ship. In the right direction. Sorry for my croaky voice. I've struggled to get through, but I made it.
No, it's good. It's all good. And to everyone out there, we hope that wherever you are, you have had a fantastic, very blessed and prayerful Lent, and that you have a happy and holy Easter season. It is the season for rejoicing and celebration in only a few days, because actually we're recording this on the 15th. So this is going to go up today, isn't it? Gavin, that's the plan.
Sure is.
That's the plan.
Yep.
So we're going to go into the Triduum.
The 15th somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going into the most holy part of the year. So we hope that you have a fantastic, wonderful, blessed, holy Easter, that you're with your loved ones wherever you are, and that we see you again next month. And until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.